We treasure originality, flamboyant originality. The old world tended to treasure conventionality. The rational and the intelligible versus the visceral and the emotional is another way I think of the differences, the aesthetic differences between ancient and modern art. That is, if you go and read St. Bonaventure's The Mind's Road to God, one of the bestsellers of the Middle Ages, you will see that the point is to move from the realm of things that are made very quickly to the realm of things that are unmade. For most of us, on the other hand, it does seem to me that for most of us, we think that something absolutely essential to any kind of literary artistic production is a strong emotional or visceral impact. Once again, an example from the New York Times, a movie ad I saw some years ago. I can't remember what the movie was, but it was a movie on an adult theme. Now, you know what that means right away, right? Adolescent sex. A movie on an adult theme, and it said, searing, tearing, ripping, like a kick in the gut, like a face full of broken glass. You will want to see this film. Well, you see, I've been hanging out in the Middle Ages long enough where I would want to take two Tylenol, probably instead of saying. But the idea is that for the work of art to be powerful, there had to be a sort of a powerful affective dimension to it. And that that affective dimension lay not in the realm of the intelligible, at the level of the ideas, but rather in the level of the experience, the frisson, the emotional engagement with the text. Now, I'm speaking in a way in caricatures and in stereotypes, but I really do think there's something major, there's a major truth here about the differences between the aesthetic expectations of medieval literature, which are primarily intellectual and spiritual, and those of post-romantic modern art. Let me give you an example from a medieval aesthetician. He's my favorite medieval aesthetician, John the Scot. And he's a favorite of mine for various reasons. Although he's called John the Scot, his name was John, not John, and he was not a Scot, so that's a very medieval thing about him in the first place. But he was also, in legend, stabbed to death by his own students with their penknives when they didn't like his lectures. Now, this is a sort of moral story for any lecturer to sort of keep your, try to keep the interest, the unflagging interest of your audience. And John the Scot says this. He says, I will teach you what beauty is in the following way. Bring me the most beautiful man-made object that you can imagine. And what he imagines is a fantastic vase that is made of precious stones and jewels, carved in porphyry, covered with silver and gold, and encrusted with jewels. And he says, bring me a large banquet table and put this thing right in the center of it. And now, I want you to go out and get me two people, a wise man and a fool. Now, this is a task that is half easy to accomplish. But in any event, you bring in the wise man and you bring in the fool and you put them at opposite end of the table and they look at this thing that is there. And their initial reaction is identical. It is the medieval equivalent of, wow, what a beautiful thing. It's unbelievably beautiful. And from there, the fool goes something like this. Wow, what a beautiful thing. Where did you get it? How much does it cost? Can I get one? Do you take American Express? So forth and so on. On the other hand, the wise man is looking at the same thing. It's the same work of art. And the analogy here, of course, is going to be with a poem or a literary construct. Looking at the very same thing, the wise man says, wow, what a beautiful thing. Imagine the skill of the maker of that object. Imagine the mind that could think up making that thing in the first place. But above all, imagine the mind that could create the mind that made that thing. And you see where you are. You're back on that Platonic ascent. You've started with the material thing and with the emotional reaction, the wow, so to speak. But it leads you not to wallowing in any sort of purely emotional or an aesthetic experience, but to a directed intellectual and spiritual experience. According to John Scott, what you're supposed to be imagining there, what you're supposed to be imagining there, is the uncreated beauty of God, the creator of all things, including the artist who has made this beautiful object. Now, there were medieval literary theorists who wrote about this with specific regard to literary texts, and one or two of them deserve our attention. Particularly, I want to tell you just a word or two about St. Augustine. St. Augustine lived between 354 and 430. He's often thought of as the greatest of the fathers of the church, and yes, he is the same person who, in slightly more upscale groups, is sometimes called St. Augustine. I call him St. Augustine because, not merely because my own great teacher, who was a great Augustinian, called him St. Augustine, but because the first time I ever heard this name was in a child's rhyme, Ach du lieber Augustine, where Augustine had to rhyme with washing machine, and you can't do that with Augustine. Although Augustine was primarily interested in approaching the text of the Bible, a number of the things that he says about the way that we might approach a literary text are extremely useful for understanding other aspects of medieval writing as well. In one of his books, a book called De Doctrina Christiana, on Christian doctrine, but where the word doctrine doesn't mean a body of belief, but more or less the way you study something in a Christian fashion, he tries to examine the very foundations of humanistic learning. He says this: all doctrina, all studying, is about one of two things. Since he wrote in Latin, I'm going to use the Latin words. Either about res, R-E-S, which means things, or signa, S-I-G-N-A, which means signs. Now, putting a rough translation of things and signs is this, that things means the natural sciences, those things we weigh, measure, chemistry, physics, all that kind of stuff. Signs, on the other hand, meant everything that we study in a humanistic way that grows out of human indirect communication. The great sign system for St. Augustine, of course, was language, and that's why his thinking is important. And what he says about it is this, among other things. He says there are two kinds of signs: natural signs and conventional signs. A natural sign, par excellence, is smoke. If you go out on the hillside and you see smoke rising, you know that that means fire. Because everywhere on earth, in Paraguay, in Russia, in Canada, wherever you are, smoke always means fire. But what about the word fire itself? What does that mean? The word fire itself means fire to you and me. But if I go to some of those other places I mentioned, the word fire won't mean anything, or it will mean something different. What does beta mean? He says, B-E-T-A. Beta, he says, means the second letter of the Greek alphabet. To a Greek, to a Roman, it means that red vegetable root that none of my kids were very keen on when they were young. It makes a big difference, that is to say, whether you're talking to Greeks or to Romans. What is gift? G-I-F-T. Gift is a good thing in English, but as those of you who know German know, in the German language it means poison. See, somebody comes up to give you gift, make sure you're in an English-speaking rather than in a German-speaking context. Now, this is extremely important in its implication, because it means that the greatest theorist of medieval linguistic theory of reading and writing insisted upon the close attention to context. That is to say, that it is cultural context that helps us understand the meaning of words. He was particularly interested in the Bible, so his examples come from the Bible. What does the word leo mean, he says? Lion. Says that word can mean either something very good or something very bad. In the riddle posed by Samson, Samson, you may recall, found and abandoned a carcass of a dead lion in the desert, and inside it honeybees had made a nest, and he formed a riddle on this: out of the strong one came forth sweetness. there in Christ, the word lion in the sentence, our enemy stalketh around as a lion to see who he can devour, the book of Job, that meant the devil. It makes a big difference whether it means Christ or the devil. Thank you.